On Tuesday, February 23rd, the Supreme Court heard a one-hour oral argument for Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project to determine whether several key terms in the definition of prohibited material support of terrorism violate the First and Fifth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. This case marks a challenge to the Patriots Act at the Supreme Court level and addresses the overbroad scope of the prohibition on material support to listed terrorist organization, which has an impact on peace building and other organizations of U.S. organization in conflict zones around the world. Joining us this morning to help unpack some of the issues surrounding this case is Stephen Vladek, who is a professor of law at the American University at the Washington College of Law, where he teaches and researches focused on federal jurisdiction, national security law, constitutional law, and international criminal law. He was part of the legal team that successfully challenged the Bush administration use of military tribunals in Guantanamo Bay, and has co-authored amicus briefs in a host of other lawsuits which challenged the U.S. government's ability to conduct surveillance and detentions of terrorist suspects.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, look, we're honored and welcome aboard.
Thanks.
Well, I know that some of the work that we had received was before you'd actually had before the case actually went to the Supreme Court. So could you talk a little bit about your work leading up to their hearing and then talk about what you see of the results of the hearing?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, it's a nasty, complicated case, and so I think it helps to sort of lay out all the pieces. You know, starting in 1996, Congress made it a crime to provide material support to groups that are designated by the Secretary of State to be foreign terrorist organizations. And the specific crime Congress prohibited was, as you say, giving material support to these groups. The hard question is, what is material support?
Exactly.
You know, what does it actually mean to provide material support? Now, Congress tried to provide some elaboration. Congress said, you know, material support includes providing training. It includes providing personnel. It includes providing, quote, expert advice or assistance, unquote. But the problem is, you know, that seems to sweep in a whole lot of activity, including things that we would think are perfectly protected by the First Amendment. So this lawsuit started shortly thereafter. It's mostly about two foreign terrorist organizations, the PKK, which is the Kurdistan Workers' Party in Turkey, and the Tamil Tigers. And the thing about these groups is that they're both, you know, both of them have been guilty of various violent activities in the past, but they're also both, you know, independence groups. And they're both groups that are actually trying to work toward long-term stability, one in Turkey and one in Sri Lanka, even if sometimes their means are not particularly good ones. So the real question in this case is, can Congress prohibit Americans from helping these groups, at least with regard to their nonviolent activities, from helping them advocate before the United Nations, from helping them, you know, build up their sort of ability to stabilize conflict-prone areas? And that's exactly why this has such implications for American peace-building efforts around the world.
And to unpack what we mean by their nonviolent activities, we're talking about receiving trainings sometimes from Americans to help them learn nonviolent and conflict resolution techniques. That's some of what we're talking about, correct?
That's right, Celeste. And I think actually it's not just training in nonviolent techniques. It's also training in sort of, you know, democracy building.
And collective,
you know,
and bargaining.
Exactly. Well, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But also, you know, I mean, I think it's also, I mean, one of the fascinating moments in the oral argument last week is at one point Justice Breyer asked the Solicitor General for the United States, you know, whether under the government's view of this statute, a lawyer would be prohibited from even filing an amicus brief, you know, a friend of the court brief,
yes,
on behalf of one of these organizations, because that would be providing them with expert advice and assistance. And I think to everyone's surprise, the Solicitor General said yes. And so that's why I think this case has raised so many, you know, concerns, because I think, you know, we could probably all agree that no one should be allowed to go help al-Qaeda with almost anything. But when we're talking about these more marginal groups that have done some bad things in the past, but that are also trying to work toward peace, is it really the case that Congress can prevent all of us from, you know, doing things as sort of unintentionally violent and sort of, you know, unmalicious as filing a brief? I think that's really why this is such a big deal.
Now, it's my understanding that as this case has proceeded up towards the Supreme Court, the lower courts have ruled in favor of the Humanitarian Law Project. Is that correct?
That's right, Cecil. In fact, the you know, it's the courts out where you guys are. So it's the Federal Court of Appeals in for the West Coast, the Ninth Circuit, which has actually heard this case three different times. And each time the court has said there are problems with the statute centering on the vagueness of these provisions. And what the court has meant is, you know, when Congress says it is illegal to provide training or it is illegal to provide, quote, expert advice or assistance, it's not sufficiently clear to the informed observer where the line is between what is, you know, properly prohibited by the statute and what is, in fact, conduct that is protected by the First Amendment. And so that's why the Ninth Circuit has invalidated at least three of the provisions in the statute. And it's that, it's the government's appeal of the last decision by the Ninth Circuit from 2005 that is what the Supreme Court heard last week.
We're speaking this morning with Stephen Filatek, who is professor at Washington College of Law, American University, about free speech peacemakers and the Supreme Court. Last week, February 23rd, the Supreme Court heard a one-hour oral argument about Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project to determine whether or not certain aspects violate the First and Fifth Amendments of the Constitution. This case has given concern for many people, many organizations, and so we invite your careful listening and give us a call if you have some concerns. Our numbers here are
503-231-8187.
I'm sorry, it just left my mind for a second. Professor Filatek, a little bit more about the history of this law. When I first heard about it, I thought it was addressing the Patriots Act, but I understand it was address a law that was enacted before that in 1996. So it's something that has developed over the years. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. And I think actually, I mean, the Patriot Act is part of the story. So, you know, you weren't wrong to focus on that. The statute started in 1996, you know, right about the time that we were first really starting to worry about the impact of international terrorism in the United States. The first World Trade Center bombing was in 1993. On a more sort of domestic front, the Oklahoma City bombing was in 1995. And so at least when the statute was enacted, you know, we hadn't really started to think about al-Qaeda and that kind of group, but we were starting to worry about the problem of transnational terrorism. After 9/11, you know, after the September 11th attacks, when Congress revisited the issue in the USA Patriot Act, they actually expanded the statute. So one of the provisions that's at issue in this case, the prohibition on providing, quote, expert advice or assistance, unquote, was actually added in the USA Patriot Act. So we have sort of two steps. We have, you know, the sort of pre-9/11 origins and then the post-9/11 expansion of the statute. And I think it's also telling that even though this case started before 9/11, this statute more generally has been a very big part of both the Bush and Obama administration's post-September 11th counterterrorism policy. They've brought over 150 cases in the criminal court since 9/11, where this statute was at least one of the charges. So it's a pretty big deal, and that's why I think, you know, although this one little case is about these two specific groups, it could have much more sweeping implications.
Well, I've got a couple of questions. The first one is, if there's an issue about providing expertise, how would that allow the organization to defend itself in a court of law?
Well, I think, I mean, so that's exactly the question that the Supreme Court asked the Solicitor General. And I have to say, just, you know, at least from my perspective, I was quite surprised that her answer was it would not. I think, you know, that will bother, I think, most of the justices on the court, and not just the more, you know, liberally inclined. I think, you know, the government's position more consistently has been that the kind of expertise we're talking about, you know, reduces rather simply to technical expertise, so bomb making. And I think, you know, we could probably all agree that the government is well within its rights to prohibit, you know, physicists and chemists from lending their expertise to these kinds of organizations for how to build a better bomb. You know, that probably is not going to raise too many concerns that we're running afoul of First Amendment rights. But as you suggest, you know, the statute itself draws no line between the bomb maker and the lawyer. And I think, you know, that's a line that the Constitution may in fact require.
And isn't it true that in terms of the two attorneys who were arguing before the justices, or rather preparing before them, Cole and Kagan, that that's where they started kind of parsing out what exactly the material support would look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the hour of argument last Tuesday was devoted to precisely that, to the justices trying to sort of parse out, you know, what Congress could in fact prohibit, and where the First Amendment might actually impose a limit. And I think that's the right debate. I mean, I think, you know, even constitutional law scholars would struggle to provide a precise answer to that question. But that's the whole problem. The statute at issue here does not draw any fine distinctions. It just uses a broadsword and defines these, you know, these terms without very much in the way of specificity, leaving it up to us. And I think the concern that these groups have, the concern that the plaintiffs in this case have, is that it's not worth it to them to risk it and to sort of push the envelope, that, you know, the fact that the statute is vague is going to force them to abandon all kinds of activities that may in fact not be unlawful, simply because it's not clear enough that the statute doesn't reach them.
Well, that, I think, raises a very important question for many organizations, many organizations which may not have the financial assets to you know, hire lawyers to defend themselves, the possible chilling impact it might have on organizations to operate and fulfill their missions. Do you have any sense in terms of what type of implications, if this statute is allowed to continue, might have on the ability of organizations to fulfill their missions?
Sure. I mean, Cecil, I don't even think we have to speculate. You know, there were briefs filed in the Supreme Court in this case by several human rights groups and several sort of peace-building groups, maintaining quite forcefully that already, even before this case has been decided, the uncertainty that comes with this statute has forced them to reassess their activities. So, for example, I mean, on the ground in Afghanistan today, you know, I think everyone is on the same page that it is in our national interest to try to build a stable democratic regime in Afghanistan. But given that there are a number of groups in Afghanistan who are on the Secretary of State's list of foreign terrorist organizations, these groups have to be incredibly careful about what kind of training sessions they provide, about what kind of material they provide to almost anyone they come across in Afghanistan out of fear that they might be prosecuted. So I don't even think it's about the chilling effect that the statute might have in the future. I think it's about the very pronounced chilling effect that the statute is already having today on the ability of human rights groups within the United States to do this kind of on-the-ground work in conflict-bound regions like Afghanistan, like North Africa, et cetera.
So, for example, if I'm a human rights organization and I'm operating in country X, and I'm approaching this organization and offering advice on how to establish a support group, is there some sort of list of terrorist organizations?
Right, that's just my question. And then even how do they get on that? Is there any room to dispute landing on that list?
Indeed, I mean, so there is a list, and it's published in, you know, the Federal Register, along with millions of other things that none of us ever bother to read because we can't be expected to. You know, the Secretary of State has a process that she is supposed to go through when she designates a group as a foreign terrorist organization. It's supposed to be public. There's supposed to be notice. and the group is supposed to have an opportunity to contest that designation. Mm-hmm. The reality and what has actually been true is that although it is public, although the list is available, there's been very little in the way of meaningful opportunities for these groups to challenge their designation because many of these groups have no presence in the United States. You know, the Tamil Tigers, the Kurdistan Workers Party, these are not U.S.-based groups. And so it's actually very difficult for them to show up in the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, which is where the procedure exists, and meaningfully contest their designation. What even worse, and I think what's an even bigger problem is, there's no provision, there's no allowance for a human rights group, for a plaintiff who wants to support these groups to collaterally challenge the designation. The law is pretty clear that only the group itself can challenge its status. And so if a group like PKK or like the Tamil Tigers doesn't challenge its status or is at least unsuccessful in challenging its status, that's it. And there's actually no meaningful chance for anyone to say they're not, in fact, a foreign terrorist organization. All you can do is hope that the support you're providing to them isn't prohibited by the statute.
So in other words, if, say, as a U.S. citizen, for whatever in whatever combination, whether I'm natural or naturalized or whatever, mm-hmm. I have relatives who are engaged in that, and I am an attorney, you're saying that I cannot argue on behalf of this organization to help them be removed from the list without being considered giving them material support.
And that's the exact
So that's a catch-22.
You've got that exactly right. And listen, I think that's why I at least was very surprised that the government made such a big deal out of the legal support, because I would have thought the government would understand that that's exactly where the Supreme Court, even this Supreme Court, is going to get very nervous. You know, that whatever may whatever else we might say about other forms of support, that allowing them to have representation in court really is necessary. And, you know, would raise serious problems under the First Amendment if you cut off that ability.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Please join in the conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187. And we're speaking with Professor Stephen Vladeck, and we're talking about the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project and how the opportunity to support even peaceful means for groups and organizations that have been deemed terrorist organizations by our United States can land you in jail. One of the things that's really interesting, and it's kind of leaked down to, I'd say, the average person's level, is the fear that even having conversations with people who are parts of these organizations can be detrimental. And it's being looked at as the new McCarthyism. Any comments on that?
Well, Celeste, I think you're right to sort of analogize it to McCarthyism. There are a couple of important differences. That's not to commend the differences, but at least to describe them. Mm-hmm. The statute at issue here, the material support statute, was amended in 2004 to require that any material support be knowing. And so what that means is that you actually have to know that the people who you're talking to and the groups to which you are contributing, whatever you're contributing, are in fact involved in illegal activities and or are on this list of foreign terrorist organizations. So it's no longer the case that you can get in trouble by accident under the statute. I mean, you really do have to have some intent now to be liable. That being said, you know, there are some parts of the world where you know that the people in the room are bad guys and you're still trying to do good things. And so for the kinds of people who, you know, have the sort of willingness to roll up their sleeve, to go into, you know, the sketchy parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan, to go into North Africa, to go into Sri Lanka and really try to work toward peace in those areas, that's where the problem is. You know, they know that they're dealing with people who are probably up to no good. And what they're really trying to do is encourage them that violence isn't the only way and that, you know, for long-term stability, there are better things to do than just fighting against your local government. And that's why the statute is itself, you know, you said earlier it's a catch-22. I would say it's counterproductive because it's discouraging exactly the kind of activity on the part of U.S. citizens and human rights groups that might actually reduce the amount of terrorism, you know, we see in the world in the next half century.
So perhaps this dangerous law would prohibit a U.S. citizen from taking or following what the president said that he might do when he first came into office, which was to talk to different people. So my local human rights group would probably be very careful about which type of people we want to speak with.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Celeste, please.
I was just going to say, what's really interesting is what you have here is kind of an ugly mutation. The United States used to pride itself in going into other areas and bringing, quote-unquote, the light of democracy, the light of a conflict resolution. Yet we have some kind of way flipped that concept on its head, and now if you do just that, you are not promoting democracy. You are aiding and abetting.
Well, if you're doing it privately, I mean, just to be clear, you know,
a private citizen. So, like, right, for example, if we got a caravan together, like some groups do, to take computers down to Cuba, it could be counterproductive.
Well, and we'd be breaking the law.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to say, I mean, I think, you know, since this is just me, let me try to at least offer what I think the government's, you know, defensible position is here, because this is not entirely crazy.
Right.
You know, the government's view is that when you look at a group like Al-Qaeda, part of how you go after them is not just with your military, right, but you also prevent resources from getting
to freeze their resources.
That's right. And so you prevent, you know, you prevent them from getting money, you prevent them from getting help, you prevent them from getting everything. A government lawyer once said, you want these groups to be radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the abstract, that's perfectly defensible, right? I mean, you know, none of us really want to be doing anything to help Al-Qaeda. The problem is that, to me, there's a very profound difference between a group like Al-Qaeda and a group like, you know, the Tamil Tigers,
mm-hmm.
And a group like the PKK. And it's in the differences between those groups that we run into the problem here. Because whereas I suspect we would all agree that the government should be able to basically strangle groups like Al-Qaeda and groups who really exist only to do violence to us and our interests, you know, there are plenty of groups who are on this list who, although they have been guilty of crimes in the past, you know, have plenty of their work that is not about violence. And that's, in fact, about the opposite. It's about, you know, moving away from these cycles of violence and moving toward peace building and reconstruction. And so that's where the paradox is in the statute. It's not the core principle, but it's in how it's applied to groups at the margins.
So I think it's clear that they perhaps can come to some understanding as you describe some distinctions among various groups, some more dangerous than others. The challenge is, how do we define which of those core groups that we need to be concerned about are those on the margins? Is there any playbook? Does it change from administration to administration in terms of how they determine these groups?
Well, I mean, there are criteria, and the Secretary of State, who is charged by statute with administering this list, is supposed to apply these criteria and is supposed to revisit them from time to time. What's fascinating is, although you would think that would give room for there to be significant changes from administration to administration, there actually really have not been.
Mm-hmm.
So the two groups that are at issue in the Humanitarian Law Project case, the PKK and the Tamil Tigers, they were actually put on the list at first by President Clinton, or I should say, by his State Department. And then they were left there by the Bush administration, and they're still there mm-hmm. under the Obama mm-hmm. administration. So mm-hmm. I think you could see, you know, changes within administration. We just haven't. And part of that may just be there's very little incentive, you know, from the administration's perspective to take groups off the list once they're on it.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 503-231-8187. Join in the conversation with Professor Stephen Vladeck. And we're talking about Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project and its implications for organizations receiving support from U.S. citizens. Now, this doesn't have any bearing on anyone that could be considered a domestic terrorist, does it?
It shouldn't flip. I mean, I think, you know, the way that the statute's set up, the groups that are supposed to be on this list are supposed to be foreign terrorist organizations. And presumably, if, you know, the Secretary of State were to abuse her authority and, say, put a domestic group on the list, you know, an environmental group or, you know, dare I say, maybe even the Black Panthers, they'd have a fairly strong argument that they shouldn't have been on the list in the first place. And indeed, because they were domestic, they'd be in a very strong position to challenge their designation. That doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but you know, I think the various secretaries of state under this program have been fairly careful, at least about primarily going after foreign groups.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with Celeste Carey. Our guest this morning is Professor Stephen Vladeck, who is a professor at Washington College of Law, American University. We're speaking this morning about the February 23rd, Supreme Court oral argument, Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. Let me remind you that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on the OMO Variety Hour, a look at socialized medicine that is really successful right here in the U.S. And the Moles ask, is there anything worthy of support in the Obama Congress proposals on health care? At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein leads a discussion about creating sustainable projects in our neighborhoods with Selwood Moreland neighborhood activists. At 11 on Health Watch, the guest is the author of The Holistic Baby Guide, Alternative Care for Common Health Problems. At 11:30 on Madness Radio, the guest is psychiatrist Dr. Terry Coopers, author of Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars and What We Must Do About It. And we want to let you know that next Monday at 8 a.m., there will be a special talk radio show for International Women's Day. Linda Olsen-Osterlin and Annie Haynes will host a show called No Regrets, Women and Abortion. But right now, you are listening to More Talk Radio on Monday, March 1st. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Vladeck about free speech and what we need to be concerned about. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Give us a call, and we'll go to a caller at this time. Michael, thank you for waiting.
Hey, how you doing? So I just have some questions this morning, really. When you talk about the United States calling out certain terrorist groups, in my opinion, they're very selective. It's okay for a terrorist group to exist if they are carrying out American objectives, such as most recently the Aryan Nation publicly is on the media because they want to buy land in Oregon. Everybody know they're a racist organization, but that's okay. Nobody's trying to put, the government is not trying to put them out of business. KKK been around forever. That's a terrorist group. But I figure the reason that this government allows these organizations to continue to exist is because they're carrying out this country's objectives, which is a racist society. And I have one question for the professor. We talk about these humanitarian groups. They always pop up when it's dealing with foreign issues. Where are the humanitarian groups, man, when the police department is indiscriminately or summarily killing Black American citizens? I don't, like most recently when they had the marches and the meetings concerning the most recent killing, I didn't see no professor down there talking. I didn't see no humanitarian groups out. They were absent. So I'm a little confused because it seemed like the humanitarian groups only pop up when it's dealing with Afghanistan or any foreign issues, but they're never around when domestic terrorism is taking hold. So if the good professor want to address that, please explain that to me. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Professor.
No, I mean, I was just going to say, you know, it's a fair question. I mean, I don't know. I'm not familiar with the specific instance to which our caller was referring, but I will say that I think this is why you know, it's important for all of us to pay attention to these cases that don't seem to affect us as personally because they do have repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the First Amendment issues that we're talking about in the context of the ability of human rights groups and humanitarian groups to go advocate on behalf of these foreign terrorist organizations are even stronger at home and are even more important at home. And I think that's part of why these cases matter, because whatever we might feel about how important it is for, you know, groups like the Humanitarian Law Project to be able to help out the Kurdistan Workers Party, I think it's beyond question that groups should be allowed to work in our neighborhoods and to work in our, you know, underprivileged areas especially, to make sure that if there is governmental abuse taking place, that there's a voice given to the victim's perspective. And that's why I think, you know, this is actually not as attenuated a connection as it might seem between these cases and the kinds to which the caller is referring. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for the notion that we have an obligation to, you know, ensure that we're doing just as much on the home front. And that's part of why these cases matter.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why I asked, were there any distinctions made between domestic terrorists and groups and international or foreign terrorist groups because of that. That's one of the issues we face here, you know, as you said, in the United States, because you have people who are advocating actions which fall sometimes under the dubiously protected hate speech, but still are allowed free freedom of speech, First Amendment rights. And you wonder, well, okay, where is the line drawn?
Well, and I'll say this. I mean, I think, you know, it is an uncomfortable truth that part of believing in the freedom of speech is believing in freedom for the speech that we hate,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that's always been true. And so it means that, you know, we have to tolerate people who spouse, you know, who spouse things that we find deeply objectionable, because that protects our ability to say things that they find objectionable in reverse. And that principle, Celeste, I think is just as present in these cases. I mean, I personally am not sure that how comfortable I would be advocating on behalf of some of these groups, but that's not the question. You know, the question
right.
is not whether I support these groups. The question is not whether I believe in their right to do what they're doing. The question is whether, you know, I want to protect my own ability to advocate on behalf of causes that I support. And that's why these cases matter.
Excellent. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Vladeck. Our numbers again are 503-231-8187.
Monday mouth.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mario.
Mario, are you there?
Marcos,
I'm sorry.
Good morning. Yeah,
good
I just wanted to point. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to point out two things that, when we're talking about international terrorism, that the African National Congress was declared an international terrorist organization back in the apartheid era, and Nelson Mandela was regarded as a terrorist. So it's not just these obscure organizations that many listeners might not be familiar with, but the label terrorist can be thrown about pretty easily by whoever wants to use it. Also, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was never called a terrorist, but he was called a communist by the FBI, and he was under both FBI surveillance and United States Army surveillance at the time that he died. And communism and terrorism are used fairly interchangeably when when political leaders in the United States want to demonize somebody that they don't like. So back in the day, it was communist, and today it's terrorist. But those labels should be looked at with suspicion.
Thank you, Marco.
Yes, thank you for your call.
I mean, I have to agree with Marcos's point. I mean, I think that sounds exactly right. I will just say this, though. I mean, to say that those labels should be looked at with suspicion is not to say we shouldn't have the label at all. And so I think the hard question becomes, where are we going to be nuanced in our discussion?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to be nuanced in who ends up on this list in the first place? Or are we going to be nuanced in which kinds of activities we are specifically going to prohibit vis-a-vis the groups that end up on the list?
Professor, why can't we be both? Why can't we look at it, you know, concurrently?
So I think we can. I mean, I think we could say the answer is both, that we should be very, very careful in scrutinizing how groups get onto this list, and we should be very, very careful in scrutinizing what kinds of things, Congress can prohibit us from doing vis-a-vis these groups. The reality, at least in the 14 years under the statute, is that we've done neither,
mm-hmm.
Right? And that, you know, I mean, I probably would love a world where we were actually careful on both accounts. I think at least in this lawsuit, the argument is that at the very least we should pick one.
Mm-hmm.
And that to sort of, you know, leave both of these questions open to very, very ambiguous and open-ended vagaries in interpretation really does suppress speech and suppresses, you know, conduct that's protected by the Constitution.
We'll go to a next caller. And Brian, good morning.
Good morning. A couple of points, and I'll try and be succinct. I'm actually filing a complaint with the FCC right now in a fairly lengthy letter complaining about fake news, as Keith Olbermann puts it.
Brian, can you say that again? Complaining about what?
Fake news, Fox News.
Oh, Channel 6 News. Okay.
they continue to call themselves fair and balanced, and I find that some of the stuff they put on is actually treasonable. If we on the left said it, you know, the likes of Glenn, I've got nicknames for them all, but I'll keep them off the air.
Yeah, we like having our license.
but you know, the likes of Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, these guys. If anybody in the left proposed half of what they come up with, we'd all be off the air, you know, and probably in jail. And so I'm filing a complaint. Just all I ask is that Fox identify themselves as a conservative right-wing channel. And I don't know if that's anywhere near the point, but in my estimation, they're abusing free speech by, you know, having huge budgets and commercial backing. And yet, on KBOO, you can't even name a candidate that you favor unless they find that you are endorsing that candidate at election times. And a couple of more points, and I endorse completely what Michael was saying before, that there's a huge double standard here on what's considered terrorism. Ask anybody that's ever been involved with the American Indian movement. And also, last thing, if on the recent High Court ruling, by the way, I have a real problem everywhere with the stupid, ghastly obsequiousness that judges have to be addressed as. It's set up to intimidate people that can't afford a decent attorney, and I've just had a friend of mine go through that. But my last point is, if a foreign corporation can now finance American elections, you know, or American candidates, shouldn't I, as a non-citizen, be able to vote? So I'll take all that off the air and let you have a chew on it. Thank you.
Okay, you raised several points. I don't know if there's anything particular you want to address, Professor.
Well, I mean, I'll just say this. I mean, I think there is, you know, I suspect that your listeners and both of you probably feel the same way as I do, that there is a disturbing sort of race to the bottom when it comes to political rhetoric in this country these days. And that, you know, whereas there are lots of points for principled disagreement between, you know, people on the left and people on the right, a lot of what gets sort of reprinted and re-aired on television tends to be the more hyperbolic of those perspectives. And I think this case actually, you know, the case that we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes exemplifies this. You know, I think there's actually a deep and interesting question about how we draw careful lines between prohibiting contributions to terrorist organizations and protecting free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas instead, the way that it's portrayed in a lot of the mainstream media is, you know, the plaintiffs here want to be able to support Al-Qaeda and the government wants to destroy the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the more that we can do to actually add nuance to the conversation and to really, you know, allow for people to make up their own minds on what really are the points of principal disagreement, the better.
Excellent. Well, that go towards a series of questions I had in terms of the oral argument itself. I was wondering if you were able to comment on some of the specific questions that specific justices raised.
Yes.
In terms of the arguments that they heard.
Sure. I mean, so what's fascinating about the argument from last Tuesday is, you know, there's we normally expect the more conservative justices to be sort of very pro-government on these questions, and the more liberal justice to be more, you know, sympathetic to the plaintiffs. In fact, it actually kind of didn't work out that way. So the Chief Justice, for example, Chief Justice Roberts, was one of those who showed some skepticism at the government's position, especially when it came to the exchange I mentioned before with regard to filing an amicus brief in support of a designated group. And indeed, the Chief Justice was actually, I think, a bit surprised that the government was arguing so strenuously for that. So, you know, it's never easy to sort of predict how the Supreme Court's going to rule. But I will say that Tuesday's argument went badly for the government, and perhaps more badly than they would have expected, to the point where I'd be very surprised right now if the government actually prevailed.
And that's purely based on Kagan's arguments of what the material support was supposed to cover?
That's exactly right, Celeste. I mean, I think I was very surprised, and I think a lot of court watchers were surprised by how strident the government's position was, at least as expounded by, you know, Solicitor General Kagan. excuse me. I mentioned the amicus brief example, but I think in general, you know, it was surprising that the government did not take a more moderate view on the notion that, you know, there may actually be quite strong limits on Congress's power to proscribe the kinds of expert advice and assistance that these groups were hoping to provide. And so, you know, I don't know exactly how the court's going to rule, but given that, you know, the plaintiffs largely prevailed in the Ninth Circuit and the Federal Appeals Court for the West Coast, I actually would be kind of surprised at this point for the government to actually get a complete reversal. I think it's very likely the court is going to at least uphold parts of the Ninth Circuit's decision.
Well, just to illustrate what you were saying about in the course of this whole hearing, that some of the more conservative justices have been the ones that seem to have surprised everyone. I know that Justice Scalia and Justice Roberts was saying, I think that once you try to look at this as similar to communism, you weaken the whole idea because of communism is more of a philosophy. And so the attitude that we're going to use this as a way of describing prohibited activities and both legally illegal groups, or rather what I mean to say is illegal groups and quote-unquote offensive groups, the whole way that Kagan came out trying to liken it to communism was, I guess, a shot in the foot.
I think that's right, and I think, you know, I suspect that, I'll put it this way, the government's arguments in their briefs were not nearly as unequivocal on that point. And indeed, the government had actually offered a lot more nuance in its briefs about how this was not like communism and how the statutory regime that Congress had created in 1996 differed substantially from the since repudiated regime that Congress had, you know, put into place in the 1950s to deal with communism. So I actually think that strategy backfired from the government's perspective of trying to analogize this to communism, because I think on two fronts, first, the justices are familiar with their own precedents that took a rather skeptical eye, at least at the end of the day, to Congress's ability to prohibit affiliation with communism. But second, this isn't communism, as you say. This is at best superficially similar. And in fact, what Congress has tried to do is quite distinct. And so, you know, the government's theory needs to be based much more specifically on why Congress can legislate so sort of sweepingly in an area that's fraught with First Amendment concerns.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Vladeck, and we have two callers online. We'll try to get you in. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Hey, I just had a comment. You know, I just see so much time energy spent throughout the media, et cetera, you know, and like all the Justice Department and the State Department, they just spend all this time and energy talking about all these groups really harmless compared to, I mean, by the U.S. State Department's own definition of terrorism, the U.S. State Department is by far and away the greatest single perpetrator of terrorism and has been for a long time. And then all the people that, you know, fall in behind us are not the ones that the U.S. State Department is talking about, but rather is our allies, who and often are client states, who we pump billions of dollars into their countries annually. So, I mean, and then there is the far greater transgression of aggression, of which the United States, again, is far and away the number one perpetrator.
Well, if I understood the professor correctly, what he's looking at is folks who have actually demonstrated some hostilities as, I guess I'll say, the standard bearers. But, I mean, your point is good. Professor, your thoughts?
I mean, you know, I think there's always a problem when we start talking about this area of the law of our government, you know, not always having as clean hands in this field as we'd want it to. I will say, I mean, and this may be unpopular, I will say that I think that our own missteps shouldn't, in general, deprive us of the ability to go after, you know, wrongdoers. I mean, I think we should be careful to separate them out. That's not to say that we should therefore be able to, you know, go after wrongdoers without any nuance whatsoever. You know, and I think that's the issue here. But,
yes,
you know, it's a relevant part of the conversation that we have not always been so careful ourselves in drawing the kind of distinctions that, you know, we're now saying that the Constitution may very well require that we draw vis-a-vis others.
Yes.
Right. And we'll go to our last caller.
Mark from California.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Well, we might have sun, so we're good.
Well, good. First, I want to say peace to you, Sister Celeste. You know, I listen to you on an evening of Afrotainment.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And thank God for community radio, for having people like the professor where they can actually complete a thought. I wonder if the professor could walk through the process, like if you're on like a no-fly list. First of all, where do you get like the information from, the website that'll tell you if you're officially on the list? And then what is your recourse? Are there organizations? Is there a complaint procedure? Just if you could walk through us this process, please.
Sure. I mean, I think, so I guess the question is which process in particular? I mean, in the context of the statute we're talking about here, and then I can talk a little bit more about the no-fly list too, but at least here, if you know, are affiliated with some kind of group that for better or for worse ends up on this list, you know, there are remedies. I mean, the remedy is that the group is supposed to go to the Secretary of State to challenge their designation, to ask to be removed from the list. And if worst case scenario, if all that fails, the group is allowed to sue the Secretary of State in the D.C. Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court in Washington. So, you know, at least in the context of this statute, there is some means for recourse. Now, we mentioned a lot earlier in the hour that, you know, that doesn't always work very well, and that these groups have actually had some difficulty taking advantage of that procedure. More generally, I mean, I think if the question is about, you know, how we get off of these kinds of lists in general, it really does matter based on which list we're talking about specifically. So the no-fly list is an example. It's administered by, you know, the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. They've actually finally started to set up a procedure for clearing yourself if you're accidentally put on that list. I think it's called the Reprieve Program, and I suspect you can find a lot more information about it through the TSA's own website. It's a generally fair question, and I think we should be all, you know, mindful of it, of sort of when the government has this power to interfere with us by putting us on a list. You know, leaving aside the problems with that in the first place, how do we correct errors? And how do we make sure that the list doesn't have the wrong people on it? And I think, you know, there's been more and more pressure in the last couple of years with things like the no-fly list, et cetera, for the government to provide these kinds of recourses, these kinds of remedies. So I'd encourage you to sort of look more specifically at the list you're talking about. And if it's the no-fly list, look at the Reprieve Program. If it's the material support list, you know, check out the Secretary of State's website, and so on and so forth.
Hopefully the Supreme Court will issue a ruling by June. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the court's usual habit lately has been to wrap things up by June. Mm-hmm. It would surprise me if they didn't decide this case by then. It could be a little bit earlier, but, you know, I suspect this is the kind of decision that will take them a little while to get out. So I would say, you know, May or June we'll see something from them.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to walk through us this very important issue. Our constitutional rights are so important, and we appreciate your ability to share with us and to help us understand this very important issue.
Yes,
well, thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 in the Gorge and Hood River, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, and on the web, it's kboo.fm. Stay tuned. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we have the Old Mo Variety Hour, and then followed at 10 o'clock by...
by another very important show,
I
look for my notes.
And be sure to continue to listen and support your community connection, KBOO, because we have good stuff coming up at 10 o'clock.
At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein interviews a discussion about sustainable projects in our neighborhoods. At 11, Health Watch. The guest is the author of the Holistic Baby Guide, Alternative Care for Common Health Problems. At 11:30 on Madness Radio, Dr. Terry Coopers, who is the author of Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars and What We Must Do About It. And we want to remind you that next Monday there will be special programming for International Women's Day, including here on Talk Radio. Linda Olsen-Osterlund and Annie Haynes will host a show called No Regrets, Women and Abortion. Thank you for listening.
And we'll hear you 2 weeks from now.